It's time for Let Your Muscle with Lee and Phil.
Okay, everyone, we've got season two kicking off. I was going to say welcome back, Phil, but we're both here anyway. We've got we've got a couple of crackers on today, haven't we?
Yes, mate.
It's quite funny because they compared themselves to Morecambe and Wise, but I don't know whether I think they're doing themselves a bit of an injustice there, to be fair. So we've got Greg White and Andy Lane back on, both professors, both very knowledgeable. Really looking forward to talking to them and seeing what they've got to say. We've not got a specific thread to follow. We've just got them on, and we've got some questions still left over from people from before. A couple of them, I want to throw at them and just see where the conversation goes, really, because they're a mine of information. So that's the plan. We don't really need to go into the qualifications they've got because, you know, we did all that last time, but just quickly, Greg White is a professor, as I said, of sports science is his field. So he's a bit of a generalist, knows pretty much everything there is to know about physical activity and sports. And Andy Lane is a bit more geared towards psychology. So he's the last chat we had with him was a lot more. Well, it was towards the psychology side of it, obviously, but he had a lot of contribution in for everything as well because he's a big, you know, he's a big follower of the industry. So should be good, mate.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this one, mate. It's going to be good. It's good to have them both on.
Yeah, exactly. We'll get a bit of bounce back from them because they're both funny guys. So,
yeah. So let's get stuck in.
Let's get stuck in, shall we?
Awesome.
It's great to see you guys. I've been really looking forward to this.
Cool. Should be fun.
Yeah. So I've got a load of questions for both of you, obviously, at the same time. And it's just going to be a really, you know, really informal chat because, you know, last time we let it roll and we didn't edit any of it. So we just it's the same thing this time. There's a couple of questions from some of the listeners that I think are going to be really interesting and a couple that we didn't get time for last time. So we can go through those and just crack on and see how we go. Yeah,
sounds great. Sounds great.
Brilliant. Are you restricted on time, guys? We're just thinking about 40 minutes, but, you know, again, what? don't want to, you know, drag you over anything that's not good for you. So
no, that's perfect.
Perfect.
It went on for hours and hours last time. I mean, I went for a run last time. I'm not that fit. So if we are going to listen to this next time, we do need to just manage that a bit.
Brilliant. All right. I'll just do it. We've already introduced you. Me and Phil had a quick chat first. So we're just going to go in. I'll just do a quick intro and then we'll crack on then. Yeah.
Perfect.
Perfect. Ready to go, Phil?
Yep, it's already going, mate.
Oh, is it? Oh, right.
Oh dear. Right.
Yeah, I've got some bloopers. I've got some banter.
There'll be plenty of those throughout. So don't worry about that.
Yeah. That. So, welcome, Greg. Welcome, Andy. Both professors. We've already done the intro, so you know who you are, and everybody else knows who you are now. So, we've got a couple of questions, but I just want to see how you are after lockdown. How's work been? Have you been stressed, or you've been managed to get stuff done? Or
I think to some extent it's just been different more than anything else. I mean, yeah, I think we're probably both lucky that we have sport and exercise as part of our lives, and I think that makes such a big difference that actually, you know, what we have been blessed with is good weather. I think this final lockdown was that little bit more difficult because the weather was not as good as it has been. But actually now the weather's picked up and it makes such a big difference. So and also the gyms are back open. So happy days, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Finally.
Getting out. Cool. So, right. So the first question I wanted to run by you, by the way, I just had to say that you compared it to, who was it you compared it to, Andy, you two chatting? Was it Eric and Ernie.
It's more like the Crankers. I'll let you guess which one's Jimmy.
Okay, I don't mind that. I want to be Jimmy. I've got the height.
Get your school cap. And you need a school cap.
Brilliant. Right. What I wanted to talk about first was the mental health side of it. It's kind of a good one to go into because, You know, everybody's been struggling through all of this, but I wanted to delve a bit deeply from both of you really into what causes, you know, specific mental health issues deep down. Is it just a lack of endorphins? Is it something deeper going on there? Or is it, you know, when dark evenings, obviously things are going to get a bit worse anyway, but we're just talking about trying to get people out of this stupor and get back into the gym and kind of break that kind of lethargy. So, I mean, maybe you can both have a little chat about that just to see if there's anything we can do to get kind of light a fire under people's arses.
I don't think there's one thing. I think there's a there are multiple things. And so the kind of the search for what is it that is causing mental health to deteriorate over something like lockdown, you're unlikely to find one thing. Of course, the endorphins matter, and there's a link between endorphins and mood. But what you've got is a whole series of changes where people had a whole set of strategies that they used to keep themselves quite happy that suddenly had to stop. They hadn't planned to put anything in place, and therefore the factors like going for a walk, going to the gym, chatting with your friends at coffee, all those small things which you wouldn't see as important goals necessarily that when done collectively pull your mental health together, suddenly stop en masse.
Yeah, and you don't know what to
put them back with, and you don't know what to put them back with.
And I think also, I mean, to some extent, much like physical capacity, I think you have to remember that this is a nature versus nurture issue. In other words, it's sort of what our genes are, what our makeup is, what we've got biologically. But then wrapped around that is our environment. You know, what Andy is speaking to there is exactly right, is that, you know, to some extent, we are who we are. And of course, there are those people with pre-existing mental health and emotional health issues. And some of those are incredibly serious and obviously require significant support. Equally, there are sort of those that are predisposed to mental health and emotional health issues. And of course, as Andy describes, normally what we do is we create coping strategies for that as we go through life. Mm. And of course, when something like lockdown comes along, everything is suddenly curtailed almost instantly. And, you know, what we found with lockdown was just everything went. So, you know, whether it be exercise, whether it be a coffee with a friend, whether it be going to visit your parents, whether it be, you know, being with your children in a happy environment instead of a homeschooling environment, you know, all of those things changed instantaneously. And I think what's really interesting for me is that, and I've written a couple of blogs on this, is the disproportionate impact that lockdown and COVID has had on women in comparison to men.
Yeah, I read that. It's 40%, isn't it, or something? 40%?
Well, I mean, if you take a look at the ONS data, effectively what it sort of demonstrates is that women, in particular middle-aged women, have been much more affected from a mental health perspective, principally based around this idea of stress and anxiety, which has been driven by fear of COVID itself. And there was definitely an interesting piece that I wrote about the disproportionate impact of lockdown on women when it comes to physical activity. And you sort of think to yourself, well, that's because it's, you know, time of year and it's the weather and it's the fact that actually women do like group exercise. And so therefore the closure of gyms makes a really big difference. But what was really interesting about that data to me out of Sport England was the fact that the number one reason was the fear of catching or transmitting the disease for women.
Right.
It's been an interesting process. So, you know, going back to the original point, it is nature, you know, who we are, how we're made up, but critically it's the nurture, the environment which we're surrounded by.
So in essence then, really the way to get past that is to start integrating those things back into life again. So you start having those coffee chats and start going out for the walks, and rather than give yourself a massive task of, right, I've got to go back on in the gym, back in this, to start slowly and build up maybe then.
For me, it is to take tiny little steps. Each one of those is a positive step.
Yeah.
The thought of, shall I go to the gym, start looking forward to it, planning for it, it's a positive. When will I want to go to the gym? I haven't been back to the gym yet, not because the weather's so nice. But you start thinking, I can go back to the gym. That's a positive thought. Yeah. And I can see people. And you start planning. Just the small steps will start reconstructing a positive life again.
Mm. Yeah, excellent.
I think what's interesting around that, actually, is to my mind, things like the gym, it's actually an issue of confidence. And I think one of the things that a number of people, particularly those that aren't, you know, the guys that are listening to this podcast and us, you know, as we chat, you know, we're highly confident in terms of our physical capacity. We are physically literate, as we sort of coined this phrase around physical literacy, is that we know what we're doing and we know what to expect when we do it. But I think, you know, for those people who were on the low activity end of that spectrum, what they have done through lockdown is they've actually lost confidence. And I think whether you like it or not, it does take quite a lot of confidence to go back into the gym. Can be quite a scary place to be.
Yeah.
And I certainly think what Andy's saying there is absolutely right. It is about small steps. But I think also to my mind, what's crucial about this is about community. I think one of the things that we often forget about physical activity is the importance of social health. And to my mind, when I talk to people, I think it's the one thing they've really missed is actually being part of a community. Again, particularly women who around about three quarters of group exercise, which hasn't started back yet for adults, which I think is a mistake, something I'm fighting very hard to accelerate. That becomes very much part of their social sector, their social health. And so therefore building that confidence is part of this reintegration into normal life.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a good one. Yeah. I watched your webinar recently. Mr. White.
Oh dear. Sorry about that. What you're about to say is that my technical ability is very, very poor. Is that what you're going to say?
No, actually, there was one particular slide I thought I'd bring up because I thought it was really interesting. Was about and you kind of touched on it there. Was I had no idea it had dropped so much. So it's 29% of adults are inactive, and to us that inactive means one thing, but actually the way they've graded that, if you like, is less than 30 minutes of activity per week.
Jesus.
I mean, so that's what you have to be inactive, is you have to do 30 minutes.
That's,
I mean,
22 million people. I mean, you know, it's a big number.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, and that 30 minutes a week. And of course, the interesting thing about lockdowns is that what we forget about is what we like to coin incidental activity. And that is that when you go to work, invariably you've got to walk to your car, you know, if you drive, you know, or you've got to walk to work. If you're on public transport, you've got to walk to the station, up and down steps, then walk to your workplace, all of that sort of stuff. When it came to lockdown, what we saw is a dramatic, interestingly enough, during the first lockdown, if we can cast our minds back that far into history.
Yeah, when it was sunny.
The weather was fantastic.
Yeah, it was
a good time. And what we saw is a relative plateau in physical activity during the first lockdown. And in some sectors, you know, some portions of the population, we saw a rise because actually it was being promoted constantly. And even for the very first time, a chief medical officer in situ, in office, came out and extolled the virtues of physical activity, irrespective of disease status. You know, so all of a sudden everyone's talking about it and everybody's doing it. We take a look at the third lockdown. What we see is a dramatic fall.
Yeah.
Weather, short days, a little bit of sort of lethargy and a bit of desensitization. This is the third lockdown, you know, so motivation and confidence are very low. And so, it's been a really interesting process because of that. But what we are seeing is we're seeing a very large number of people who are doing less than 30 minutes a week. Now that is, it's frightening when you put it into that context.
Yeah. That's easily done.
Yeah.
What was that? Sorry.
Well, it's easily done because there was one day where I hadn't walked the dog and the weather was bad and I had done 600 steps. 600 steps. Yeah. That was probably to the fridge. It's really easily done.
Yeah.
But that is one of the highlights of the step counter watches, isn't it? In that, I mean, for all their inaccuracies at the top end, they're pretty good at telling you you're inactive.
Yeah.
And I picked this up when I was running quite a bit, and then you put one of the watches on, you think, good Lord, you're actually not that active. You've got this delusion that you are active, but you are doing quite a bit of exercise, but you're inactive so much of the time. Mm. And so you can then go, well, this is actually not very good. I sit down all day. And lockdown and so on meant that everything had to be consciously put in. Otherwise, the longest walk you'll do is, I could go upstairs, but I'm not going upstairs for the next hour. It's too much. And so on. You're static the whole time. Yeah. But the conscious effort, conscious activity takes effort. And people, that exhausts you. So the idea you have to go for a walk every hour for a little bit, it's too much. It takes too much planning for for most people, and therefore the inactivity then wins.
Yeah.
And then jobs become uncertain, and people are pressured into meeting after meeting after meeting. Their daily life gets very difficult. The ability to really take control, and Greg's, our job, my job, and yours probably the same, is to have enough self-regulation in your job to actually go, no, a walk or something isn't what's needed. Where people don't feel they have that control puts them in a very, very difficult, very difficult position, almost reinforcing you have to be at your office the whole time, and you're in a real slippery slope around being able to value activity. And, yeah. and I know this, the difficulty people have, on one hand, they've got an aspect saying you should value your physical and mental health, but on the other side to it, you're not given the opportunity and capacity to be able to do that. And that just creates a lot of conflict. And there, that conflict is a massive predictor of negative health, negative mental health.
Yeah,
and the sort of fix around that is to take control, and they have to be tiny steps. I will go for a 1 minute walk, 2 minute walk, or 5 minute walk, or something like that within the day to create more activity. And it feels awfully mechanistic, but actually it makes a big difference if you can implement it.
Mm.
Yeah, the webinar I was talking about there was the global obesity webinar.
Yeah.
And there's just something, just delving into what you were just talking about there. If you could click your things and just, a magic kind of click, and you could put these things, some things into place that would help people. What would you do? What do you think that needs to happen globally? But I suppose let's just look at the UK even, to get people up and moving more, because the way it's looking at the moment, it's pretty depressing reading. What do you think needs to happen? I mean, if you could just go click, right, that's in place, from a government level, or from a Sport England level, wherever you're coming from. What do you think? You know what?
I mean, that is the $1 million question.
Yeah.
Trillion dollar.
Yeah, it probably is. And that we don't have time to answer. But I mean, I guess certainly one of the things I would do is, like, what you've got to create is a culture of activity.
Right.
And the way to create that culture of activity is to change behavior. And certainly what we do know, and Andy will speak to this, that changing behavior of middle-aged and older people is virtually impossible to do.
I mean, it's so difficult to do,
you know. I mean, it's not impossible, but, it's very difficult to do. But actually, changing behavior of children is that much easier. And I think that what we have done is that we have, in this obsessive capitalist approach to life, where GDP matters more than anything else, year-on-year growth matters, what we've also done is that we've taken education and we have fundamentally focused it on STEM subjects and SATs and exams and, and because of that, what we've done is we've marginalized physical activity, and to the point where Ofsted doesn't even take a look at PE in schools. So PE is not inspected in schools. Really? We make this sort of nod to physical health by the measurement program in primary schools of kids, where we measure their height and weight, fundamentally to vilify people, to say whether you're fat or not fat. It's an obesity scale, which is very incredibly crude. BMI is a very poor measure.
Yeah.
Instead of what we should be doing is actually measuring activity. Let's measure the fitness. What we do know is that cardiorespiratory fitness, VO2 max, is a very strong predictor of outcome, of more, not only mortality, early death, but also of morbidity, quality of life. And yet we do nothing with that. So I think certainly one of the things that I would do if I had a magic wand and click my fingers is that I would focus very much on physical education, because this, again, comes down to a physical literacy issue and a confidence issue.
Yeah.
Is I would focus that at primary schools, bearing in mind that, to go on to another subject, which I am very passionate about, and that is swimming, is that it is in the regulations, in Ofsted regulations, that every child should be able to swim when they leave primary school at the age of 11. Still to this day, 1 in 3 children cannot swim. That means they cannot swim 25 meters unaided. And yet that is a requirement. Who cares about that? Well, we care about it because one person drowns every 20 hours in the UK. And of those people that drown, 80% don't intend being in the water. So these aren't people who go for a swim and drown. These are people who are walking along the riverbank and slip and fall in and drown. The ball goes in, one of the kids goes after it and they drown. They fall into the pond in their back garden and drown. Swimming saves lives. And yet even now, you know, in a modern Western society, we don't teach our kids to swim appropriately so that every kid at the age of 11 can swim 25 meters unaided. Yeah. So to my mind, what we have fundamentally is that we have moved to a position of mass child neglect. And I think if we are to change it around, change culture and move to a culture of physical activity, the best place to target that is at children.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. What about you, Andy? What would you? How would you click your fingers and solve the world's problems? No pressure at all.
And the interesting observation is that as we went into the first lockdown, and Boris came out and said you've got an hour a day to be physically active, a wave of activity came out for people to use that hour, and it was lovely to see physical activity being prioritised in part of the general health of people. And what was missed there was the opportunity to keep that going. Make sure you use your hour. Make sure you take an hour. Make sure you build from an hour. And then make the opportunity to put a connection between getting physically fit and all not just COVID, but all of the other diseases that you would be reducing your likelihood of having serious consequences with was an opportunity, whilst people were given the encouragement to. You want to change behaviour, you've got to incentivise people to make them feel that they're going to be incentivised to do something, make them feel it's valued. And what Boris did in the 1 hour was value, tell you that that's valuable, and people then prioritise it, which was good. And you've got to continue to do that. And you could continue to do that quite easily. You could reinvigorate the whole gym industry by having people allowed to get themselves tested by within gyms for certain to pass physical fitness tests, and that might be able to offset insurance and so on and so forth.
Yeah,
you could bureaucratize it and make an industry out of being fit is helpful for you and preventing you from other diseases which are not communicable.
It's more of a stick than a carrot then in that one.
Well, no, that's it's a carrot. It's go and get fit and save yourself cash and all those lifelong benefits as well. But
I think the idea of stick and carry, you have to be very careful of it in terms of a stick. But I mean, there are stick things that you could use, and what we do know, incidental activity around things like the built environment are really important. You know, town centres used to be car free. You know, now you can drive up to the shop front and you know, drive as close as you possibly can, because God forbid you'd actually walk into a shop. Yeah. You know, but you know, things like, you know, make town centres pedestrianised. You know, put car parks further away. Obviously, you know, I mean, I can hear people in the background saying things to me around, you know, things like disability and that. I mean, what we have to do is make sure that we're providing opportunities for everybody.
Yeah.
But equally, I think that there are lots of things, and you could view them as being sticks. In other words, that you enforce in incidental activity by changing the built environment. You know, put lift instead of the first thing that you see when you walk into a building being the lift.
Yeah,
make it the stairs. Put the lift in the back far corner, and make it smell of urine, like they do with the stairs in buildings, you know. And so they make them utterly unattractive. I mean, I remember pushing something out on social media last year. I can't remember which tube station it was. Might have been Great Portland Street, and at the bottom there was a sign, and it said stairs. For use in emergency only.
Yeah.
Thought, that's where we're at in society.
Yeah, I've got a good one for you. David Lloyd, Maidenhead. I worked there for many years, and I'm not kidding you. You go in through the front door, and you go on an escalator to go into the gym.
Say no more.
It used to crack me up. And the complaints, and this is genuine, there used to be serious complaints when it broke down. Honestly, people used to have a proper moan.
It's ironic,
escalator's
isn't it?
Broken again. We're like, yeah, it's one floor, mate, really. Like, you know. And another moan was, we used to get people moaning constantly about the car park being full at the front, so they had to park their car at the back and walk round. People genuinely used to moan about it. I wouldn't even hear of it. It was just be quiet. It's ridiculous. Yeah, but I totally feel on that.
But it's that brings it down to a cultural issue. And I think what we've just got to do is we've got to change culture. And I think actually Andy's right that we had, I hope we still have, a fantastic opportunity. You know, COVID has been dreadful on all sorts of levels, without any shadow of doubt. But yeah. But there are things that have happened which are very positive. And I think what we've got to do is take hold of those positive things. One of them being the importance. There was a lovely paper published last week by a very good friend of mine, Bob Salas, over in LA. He works for a group called Kaiser Permanente. It's an insurance, health insurance company. But they looked at circa 50,000 COVID patients and showed that the biggest predictor of hospitalization and death was inactivity.
Yeah.
You know, so what we have learned through this is the fundamental importance of being more active more often. And I think if we can grab hold of that and keep that momentum going, it will make a big difference to public health.
Yeah.
And just there's an opportunity for your gym providers, Tesco's and so on and so, to actually join that promotion that you'd want. There's a classic experiment is to prime someone about their physical fitness intentions prior to an exercise, no exercise choice. So stairs v lift choice. And you put in front of that a picture of someone going, do you want to, you know, what's your New Year's resolution to get fit? And of course, when you prime the motive, you get more actions to people to actually take those take the physical activity option. Well, why not at David Lloyd or any of the other gyms say start your warm up and big signs around the back of the car park, that
great idea
park at the furthest apart. Why not the supermarkets go 10,000 steps a day? You're running a little bit short. And have a walking route around the back end and actually create a walking route so that people can actually walk around without being run over by the cars coming in. So it's partly attractive. So it's not the option being is that there's a prestige status to park at the front, because that's kind of where it sits, what it looks like within society, but actually an opportunity to do something with your time, which is slightly better than. And the gym's making use of that. The stair bin being a classic one for that. We did some work with UK Active where they got kids to be active by putting in a slide. And someone said, "Well, how will putting in a slide make the kids active?" So we don't care about the slides. What we're doing here, we are getting them to do interval running uphill. Yeah. What we have now is a big wide route up to the slide, which is big and wide, which gets loads of kids on it, and you can come down as fast as possible, and you can go up as fast as possible. So.
Yeah.
Actually, if you're not stuck by only getting three rides by having a big queue. You're stuck by how fast you can come down that slide and how fast you can go up to it again. What a mess. You don't imagine trying to go to taking a lesson and going, right, kids, we're running up and down the hill. It's Monty Python, isn't it? Up and down the square. No, you don't. But you go, actually, no, you're going sliding down. Let's see how you go slide down. And how do you get up? You go back up the back, you go up the hill, you go up, and then you go, we've even made it easier for you by not having it straight up. So we make it a bit longer and wider. To do things like that. Why? And that's how you create fun out of it and you create kids fitter.
Yeah, definitely. I want to take a bit of a change in conversation there now towards like hormonal stuff with men and women, but in particular talking about like TRT and we're going to just delve into a little bit of that recently, because we've had one of the questions was about post-menopause working out and TRT working out. So what are your thoughts on the way that, you know, obviously testosterone drops quite quickly for men, and then with women it's quite a sudden drop, but do you think TRT is actually useful to help get people back into training? Is it? I mean, because a lot of blokes really drop off quite suddenly and then lose a lot of muscle mass and bone mass and that kind of thing. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, so it's, I think it's a really interesting one. And again, I've sort of written much on this. And in fact, one of my PhD students did their entire PhD on human growth hormone. On GH, which is interesting, very expensive to analyze, let me tell you. really interesting work. I think, you know, we sort of, the common parlance in society, we understand menopause, or certainly, I use that term advisedly, understand, particularly when we come to men, but we certainly know of it, and we sort of know what it's about. But the interesting thing is that men go through a similar process, what we call somatopause. which is primarily driven. Yes, it's driven by a drop in testosterone, but it's growth hormone that's dropping dramatically, very dramatically. And of course, what we know is that with men and women, the outcome of somatopause or menopause is going to be, as well as hormonal, that's going to lead on. There's a cascade into physical response, psychological,
yeah.
So mental and emotional response to that. And so, to some extent, where exercise plays a really key role is actually in offsetting that. Now, can you reverse it? I mean, I think we would be on fairly safe ground to say that you can't reverse it. But what you can do is you can offset that decline. So you can, rather than it being a very steep decline, you can actually flatten that decline slightly more. For men, for example, when it comes to GH and testosterone, what makes a difference? Well, fundamentally, what makes a difference is intensity. Is that we know that physical activity, exercise, is important in GH secretion and growth hormone secretion. But what we also know is that the higher the intensity, the greater the secretion. What we also know is that strength training, and again, you know, what's the downstream cascade of that lower GH, lower testosterone, is atrophy, is a loss of muscle mass. We can call it sarcopenia if you like. It's not really a pathologic process. It's just a natural process of atrophy where you get reduction in cross-sectional areas of the muscle. And result of that is a reduction in strength and a reduction in power. And so therefore, without any shadow of doubt, something like strength training is absolutely fundamental as an intervention during that period for men. So to some extent, what you are looking at is you're looking at exercise, which is high intensity, which has got a significant strength base to it. And within that strength base, you know, as always, we sort of tend to think, oh, you know, as we get older, we'll do less and less. Of course, what we want to involve in there is hypertrophy work, because we're trying to maintain muscle mass or increase muscle mass. So it is about lifting heavy, low rep, high weight, and you know, not to be afraid, and certainly not to be sucked into that dogma that as we age, we should do less. What we should be doing is more.
Right, that's interesting. So when you define high intensity, do you define it? Where are we going?
I'm taking you to the front door. There we go.
What does your house look like? It's like, I feel like
it's all sorts. Have a look around. It's great.
It's like MTV Cribs.
That's it. Yeah. Oh, hello. Yeah, there you go. That's my wife saying I'm a pain in the back. Anyway, go on.
Right. Oh, okay.
Good. Yeah. So what was that? What was the question again? I've forgotten that.
So have I, actually. That's a speedy route around your house. No, that's all right. Don't worry.
No, so I mean, you know, that's for men. For women, you know, what's the downstream cascade?
Oh, it was the intensity, wasn't it? So how do you define intensity? Would you say it's low amount of rest time between sets, that kind of thing, or higher? Are you talking about heart rate? So how do you define intensity?
So, I mean, a really interesting question. So if we think about training volume is intensity, frequency, and duration.
Yeah.
So to increase volume, we can do it more often, we can do it for longer, or we can do it harder.
Yeah.
Now, of those three, the most potent stimulus comes from intensity. And that's why, actually, interesting enough, this sort of return back into training from COVID, I've done a number of podcasts and webinars around this, is that even for athletes coming back in, what you have to do is grade it back in when it comes to intensity, because of the period of time of relatively lower intensity. So intensity is the most potent. And what we're talking about with intensity, effectively, you know, to coin it, we're talking about how hard it is. How hard does it feel? And so you can talk about RPE, rating of perceived exertion.
Yeah.
You can talk about heart rate, particularly when it comes to aerobic-based exercise. Remember that you don't get heart rate steady state until around about 3 minutes of activity. So for efforts that are shorter than that, heart rate becomes a little bit difficult to use. And so therefore you would tend to work off pace. So velocity or power output, if you're on a bike. And then of course, when it comes to strength training, you're talking about weight. So you talk about what you're lifting and usually, you know, either absolute or as a percentage of 1 RM. Yeah. So different ways to look at it, but intensity really is very important in that picture.
Yeah. Yeah.
Stop taking it easy. Maybe after gradually ramping it back up, obviously.
Yeah.
You've got to coach yourself into the I can cope with this intensity mindset. And and training. And the age part is the easy out, easy get out in many cases. So I'm too old. I used to be able to do this. I can't do this anymore. And it's the too old part is such an easy way for people to not want to pursue difficult goals. And it's really, have a look at yourself. Well, do you want to push yourself that hard and you don't want, if the answer is no, that's fine. But the shortcut pill is not necessarily the answer either. That you might be, you got to actually, if you want that, then there's a whole series of things you can do to bring yourself back. And the however way you look at it, you will need to be engaged in some sort of training, which at quite a high intensity, and that, you know, there's not a shortcut around that in doing that, because the high intensity training, high effort, is always high effort. If it feels easy, it's not high effort.
Yeah. Obviously, if you've got injuries, if your mobility is reduced, obviously you just work around it and you train as hard as you can in the best way that suits you. Like you said earlier about swimming. If you can't run anymore, then you can swim fast. That's a really important one. Thanks for that.
I think, you know, Nelson Mandela coined it beautifully, and what he said was, it always feels impossible until it's achieved.
Well, yeah, 4 minute mile is a good example, isn't it?
Yeah. And there are some great examples, but I think what Andy speaks to is absolutely bang on. So actually this morning I did a session that I do, which is 30 minutes steady state on the treadmill. And what I try and do over in prepping for an event is that I get faster and faster and faster as I do that. And the first session you do of that, you get on there and about 20 minutes in, you're thinking, I just cannot do this. And Andy's right. You know, one thing, you sort of look around, you think, you know, I'm in my mid 50s. I look around and think, you know, I'm an old man here. I can stop and nobody's going to care. You know, and what you, just by that perseverance, just by digging in, it's amazing what you can achieve. But once you've achieved it, all of a sudden, at points during that run, you sort of think to yourself, this is impossible. All of a sudden you achieve it. And then all of a sudden now it's possible. And of course, what that then creates, a platform to move on to the next session, which is slightly quicker. And in that slightly quicker session, you think to yourself, look, it's only half a kilometer an hour faster. And I did that. I managed to do that. So surely, and what it does is it sort of reiterates and reaffirms the potential that you can achieve it. And I think, to my mind, one of the most important things about physical activity, about exercise and about sport is belief. Because I think if you believe that you can achieve it, what you will do is you will commit the resource, whether that's effort, whether it's time, into actually achieving it. As soon as you start thinking to yourself, I can't do this, or actually I shouldn't be doing it because I'm too old, that's when you're lost. And so you've got to change that.
It speaks to how people talk about their age. And so I used to be able to do this when I was 20, and they talk about these great times of performance. When they were 20, what they also don't talk about is when they were unfit, and when the same sort of time they're doing now was also felt quite hard. You look back and everything looks better. Well, it felt difficult today, and that's more to do with your current training status than it is to do with your age. It's partly to do with your age, because you can't escape the age factors, and your peak heart rate will be a little bit lower. But there's a lot of factors you can train, and if you wanted to be slightly better next week on that task you just done, you could do so. And if you go, well, how much better? And you go, well, be 1 second better. That's an improvement, and chip away at it by how much you're prepared to train in the middle or not, and do it right in the middle. But you can get better. That mindset of I can get better, faster, stronger means that you aren't limited by your goals as much as you would have thought. Because the mindset, which I hear this a lot from runners, I used to do this, I'm just going to stop now, I'm never going to do my times before, is so utterly demotivating for them. It's not a healthy one to go to life. Because you want to be the 80-year-old who's, and I tell you what his really motivation is. If you look at the age group world championships and you see 80-year-olds properly racing each other. And it's not that they are a bit slow, but they are properly racing each other. And it's lovely to see that essence of motivation of really trying your hardest.
And for the moment of that race,
it might not be that healthy in terms of, but it absolutely all that matters. And within the training, that's they have been going through that. And that will probably be very good for their mental health, because during that period, there's something really clear to focus on.
Yeah, definitely. The thing I was going to say there was, you're into the indoor rowing as well, same as me, Andy. And you've seen
6 million meter t-shirt on the 6 million meters.
Yeah. So the when I went down there to the NEC to watch it, you're the 80-year-old guys. So there's a category for 80 plus and 90, I think, even.
Wow.
But they were really going for it. There might only be five of them, but they were all going for it against each other, really going for it. It was great to watch. But I'm going back to what you said there about, you know, working through your steady state cardio on the treadmill. When you've done it once or twice or three times, you start to identify those parts where you know it's going to be tough, and you can kind of acknowledge it and go, this is the bit that I found really hard. And then, you know, because you've done it before, you know you can push through it.
Yeah,
I think that's just a great feeling when you get to that point. And if you can break through that point, you know, there'll be a point where sometimes you'll just go, no, just hit the stop button. Can't do it today. It's not in me. But there'll be other times when you push through it, and then you can build on that, can't you? Each time you push through it like that.
And it's, you know, to coin it, knowledge is power. And I think that experience really does matter in that sense, whatever it is that you're doing. And I think having experienced it, you know what's going to happen at the end of it. So in other words, whether you can sustain it, whether you need to drop off it, and actually, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen as you go through it?
Yeah.
You know, so I think experience is really important. But, you know, speaking to Andy's point, it is very much about that. I think, you know, I think that there's very limited value in comparing yourself with what you used to do. Because to some extent, life changes. Everything changes. So yes, you're aging, but actually there are so many other things that change. You know, you've got a family, you've got a mortgage, you've got a job, you've got all sorts of other things going on in life. And critically, as we've spoken about before, you know, recovery is the one thing that I find, you know, the greatest challenge when it comes to hard training. And of course, now I'm at a position in my life where I've got very little time to recover. So, you know, to some extent, I think what you've got to always do is make sure that you do take a look at your performance in the round, you know, take everything into account and look at what you're doing. And as Andy said beautifully, that is about look at performance enhancement. You know, that's the marker. It's not what speed you're moving at. It's whether it was quicker than the last time you did it. And if you've got that gradual improvement in performance, then that should be the motivating factor.
Yeah, that's why I'm quite big on logging. I don't do a lot of cardio, but weightlifting from a bodybuilding point of view is logging my sessions and having not a random session to session. I have a set structure that I'll do for, I might leg press every week for 6 months. If I keep improving on it, it will go in. And one time I took it from 400 kilos to 600 plus. Then I stalled, and then I changed it, and that's all I did every week. And that's why I've bought myself those little 250-gram plates, because if I can just put a tiny bit more weight on every time, but I need that logbook, because sometimes I go in the gym and say, I don't fancy squatting this weight, but the logbook says you did 150 kilos last week for 10 reps, and you must, you know, man the fuck up and do even more reps.
Or, get on with it.
Or more weights. And you have to, and the logbook gives me the accountability to say, you've done this weight before. This is your current, this is your current level of performance. Unless you've got a bad, you know, you get the odd bad day, and that I need that accountability.
No, 100%. I do the same. I log all my workouts for exactly the same reasons. Yeah, it's definitely you know, something really useful to keep driving you forward, that's for sure. One thing I want to get in before, because we're knocking on with time, so I'm aware of that, but I do want to, because we missed this last time and I really wanted to ask you about this, is I've just started doing a bit of cold water swimming. So I wanted to talk to you, both of you, about, so Greg, for the physiological side of it, not that you're not capable of answering this, Andy, of course, but Andy more from the psychological side, because I want to see what the benefits are to mental health, because I hear about benefits of mental health from cold water swimming, but I don't really understand where that comes from. So maybe you can enlighten us on that.
I don't know specifically why cold water swimming would be very good for your mental health, other than what you have done is overcome a massive achievement to get in.
That's probably
water.
What it is, to be honest. But
that first part, until, I mean, Greg's gets in cold water all the time, and it's quite funny when he gets in and goes, yeah, it's lovely. And then someone else, believing that it is lovely, gets in behind them and gets the shock response. If you start to go through that ability to sustain the cold and go, yeah, I'm okay, yeah, I'm okay, you'll develop a belief that you have so much resilience. It's toughness training. I mean, pain training is typically put your hands in ice water and see how long you can sustain for. And cold and pain experiments are similar to that. And so actually you're taking part in your own pain experiment, because it is a shock to your system. You get the cold response, which you can't breathe. You're telling yourself it's going to be fine. You've read it on that you will be, you will get used to it, and you will. Well, isn't that a massive achievement? Isn't that going to make you feel good? And then if you can do some exercise, then you get all of the normal benefits of exercise that it feels rubbish in the first, well, it's actually, it's rubbish in the first 15 minutes for me, usually 10 and so on. Then it feels great. But you have to just keep going until you find that this feels great bit period.
So it's probably more about the fact that you've made yourself do something unpleasant that, that boosts your mental side rather than actually any physiological kind of blood flow increase or something. Because it was always referred to, you know, as a mental health improvement. You get mental health benefits from it, but I couldn't really understand what the process was with that. But that sprung up pretty much what it is.
I mean, there's some lovely data right now, and certainly various groups, but the University of Portsmouth are doing some really nice work on it. I mean, what you could put it into three sectors really. Number one is physical activity. So you are being physically active, and so therefore we know, you know, things like endorphins, dopamine, the happy hormones that people like to talk about. Obviously, you know, they're increased because you're being physically active. So there's one benefit, which is an acute response. Not only that, you're doing it outside. There's some lovely work that shows that exercising outdoors has a more potent impact on some of those responses. And in fact, what we see, people who exercise outdoors tend to do it harder and for longer and are much more likely to return to it. So you've now got exercise and doing outdoors. And then what you've got is you've got the cold shock response, or the response to the cold, which has a profound impact physiologically, but also mentally and hormonally. So there's some lovely work just recently published looking at this particular cold shock protein called RBM3 and its link with Alzheimer's. What we see is that we see elevated release of this cold shock protein. So there is definitely a physiological response which leads to a mental a psychological and so therefore mental health response. I guess, you know, the one thing that I always say about, I mean, I do a lot around this area of swimming, open water swimming, and cold open water swimming.
Yeah.
And we've just published the expert statement, myself and Mike Tipton, who Mike is probably the world's leading authority on cold water immersion, is I think that what's crucial is that you do it safely. I think that's by far and above anything else, is that cold open water is a very dangerous place. It's much more dangerous if you don't do it safely. I mean, it sounds obvious, but you know, it really is important that you do it well.
Yeah,
So getting to a facility that's an official facility, very important about the type of water that you're getting into. Knowledge, local knowledge of that water really matters. It's making sure that you prep before you get in. It's making sure that you know what the response is going to be. And as already mentioned, things like cold shock response. Profoundly problematic if you're out there. Never ever do it alone. Make sure that you've got the right equipment when you get out, because we've got this thing called the after drop. So actually, whilst you're in the water and moving, you're generating an awful lot of heat. We're incredibly inefficient as machines. About 3/4 of the energy we produce is dissipated as heat. And so we tend to maintain core temperature in cold water, particularly if we're just going for a dip. But what happens is as we get out of the water, that central blood volume then starts to permeate the cold periphery, and we see this dramatic fall in core body temperature, which leads to that uncontrollable shaking. but it's really important that we, you know, really important that we stay safe during that. But I mean, there's no doubt about it. Cold, and of course, you get the added bonus that it is incredibly calorific. So shivering, what's called shivering thermogenesis, when we're trying to generate heat from shivering, that could increase metabolic rate tenfold.
Oh, really?
So you strip calories very, very rapidly in cold open water. So, you know, there are some great benefits both in terms of mental health acutely and chronically into the future. But there are also some great benefits physically as well.
Oh, excellent. Well, that's a good one. Thank you for that. So we're coming up to about 40, 45 minutes, I think. I think that's... I couldn't ask any more of your time, guys, but that's brilliant. Just I knew it would be. So thank you for all of that. And awesome. if you're free again, I'd love to get you back on at some point in the future again, because that worked really well with you too. Because
I'm sure people are bored of listening to us, to be honest.
No, I bet they're not judging by the last load of feedback we had. No, so don't do yourself an injustice.
It would be great to come back and actually talk about, you know, some of the areas that Andy is absolutely, you know.
Totally. Around
performance. And Andy and I have worked, you know, a number of times on various ultra endurance events, and the psychology of ultra is something very different. And just performance in general, it'd be great to
is something I'm sure people would be interested in, the ultra events. We've got a couple of people who do those. I mean, obviously Ironman, but some of the your ultra running events. What's just out of interest, while I've got you on there, what's the furthest you've done as an ultra event?
I raced the marathon de Saab.
All right, that's marathons, is it?
So they call it the toughest foot race on the planet. So it's 156 miles across the Sahara, and you do it over. Oh God! Over six successive days, but marathon, double marathon, marathon, 10K,
double marathon.
Yeah,
that's two words that just shouldn't be put together.
Oh, yeah, madness! And in fact, the year I did it was the 30th year, and they thought, "Oh, we'll make the long." It's called Le Jour Long. It's the long day, and they wanted to make it their longest ever day, so they added a few kilometers and they made it 90K.
Across the Sahara.
It was only 55 degrees C. So it
wasn't
that bad. It wasn't that bad. I mean, I got a great tan.
I bet you did. What about you, Andy? What have you done? Have you toyed with the old ultras? Have you done much yourself? Or
ultras? I've done 12-hour runs. Parts of teams, and 24 rounds parts of teams. You run 60, 80 miles hours.
That's running away from home, by the way. Just trying to get away.
I've done long distance swims. I did a 1,000 length swim once for charity. Road marathons.
1,000 lengths of swimming? It's non-stop?
1,000 length in a swimming pool. Yeah. My sport starts from a different perspective of endurance. I was a boxer from a boxing family. I was a boxer for 10 years, and I went to other sports from boxing. Sorry?
Hence your looks.
Exactly. What was your boxing name? What was your boxing name? Go on.
It's the same name as it is now.
Didn't you have anything catchy and mean? Come on.
No.
Not wrestling.
I think Looney Lane or something. Right, brilliant. Thanks, fellas.
Cheers, guys.
An absolute joy.
Okay.
Always a pleasure, guys. Great Always to see you. Good.
Thank you very much. Talk to you next time. Cheers.
Look forward to it. Cheers, guys.
If you enjoyed this episode of Mature Muscle, please subscribe and find us on most social media. Until next time, stay shredded.